Support for WPR comes from the Lawrence University Conservatory of Music, celebrating 150 years of expanding student artistry through traditional, creative, and integrative experiences. More at lawrence.edu.
Support for WPR comes from Isthmus Partners, an independent asset management firm offering comprehensive financial planning and tailored investment solutions for clients nationwide. More at isthmuspartnersllc.com.
A world built on speed, productivity, more, 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 and far too few bathrooms and bathroom breaks does not consider or care for the actual bodies we live in. In other words, ableism affects all of us, whether we consider ourselves disabled or not. Those are the words of Rebecca Tosick in her groundbreaking book, Sitting Pretty, The View from My Ordinary, Resilient, Disabled Body, selected as UW-Madison's Go Big Read. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. My guest today is author and disability advocate Dr. Rebecca Tosick. Her memoir and essay, Sitting Pretty, tells us in honest, unflinching prose about her experience as a paralyzed girl and woman in a wheelchair, learning to navigate everything from dating to teaching to finding an accessible place to live in a world lacking in inclusivity and imagination. Welcome to University of the Air.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for your book. I have to say that reading Sitting Pretty changed my perspective on a lot of things, and I really admire the honesty of it and also just its beauty as in terms of prose. You've got wonderful metaphors and concrete ways of taking us with you as you go into a grocery store or a slumber party or a wedding, you know, just many different places that we're right there with you. Can you say something at first about your title, Sitting Pretty, The View from My Ordinary, Resilient, Disabled Body?
Sure, yes. And thank you. Thank you for the appreciation of the language itself. I think that often in conversations, we talk about the content a lot, but each word was very carefully and intentionally chosen and the metaphors and all of that. So thank you for that recognition. Yes, the title. Okay, so the origin story, or the very first baby seeds of this book, started several years earlier when I actually started an Instagram account. It was, I imagined it as this container to hold a lot of the little tidbits of reflection and storytelling that I was doing at the time. It was kind of the first time in my life when I was starting to write about disability and what life felt like from this very particular point of view. And I literally sat at a coffee shop with my then boyfriend and like brainstormed titles for the Instagram account on this little napkin. And I wish I had that napkin. I think there were a lot of cheesy things on that list of trying to come up with something that was playful, that seemed to intersect with disability in some way. And the Sitting Pretty, I think what I ended up liking about that was that it signaled, it was playful, a conversation about disability that didn't have to be solely dire or tragic, but that it was playful and signaled, like, we're doing okay here, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's where we landed. And then when the book was coming to be, the publishers felt pretty adamant that that needed to be the title of the book, which I was okay with because I agonize over titles, so that made it easy for me. And then we spent another 3 weeks trying to figure out this subtitle. But yeah, that it started on a napkin in a coffee shop.
It's interesting that you have the word ordinary in there in the subtitle. So you have ordinary and disabled together, which is kind of making a point that that you can be disabled and ordinary in a certain way, and the resilience as well that's factored in there. So in the preface to your book, you really invite the reader to come on this journey with you. I think of these openings of different books like Huckleberry Finn, where, you know, Huck Finn says, you don't know about me except you've read this book, Tom Sawyer, or the Moby Dick words, call me Ishmael, or, you know, the opening line sometimes draws a reader in, or even just things with Jane Eyre where it's, you know, at the end, reader, I married him. But you really bring the reader right in by talking about feeling awe at this moment that you're having with the reader. And I feel like you're in conversation with readers, kind of like you and I are right now. It feels very intimate. Can you talk about that as a strategy for the book?
Yeah.
You know, this doesn't feel like a detached academic essay about disability. This feels like we're sitting at a coffee shop having a conversation.
I did get some goosebumps with you describing it that way, because that would be my hope. It's interesting to hear you use the word strategy, too, because I think there is a way in which that form of writing, that tone in the writing is strategic, right? Like there is an effect of that. But I think also it felt like the true story that I had in me was that I did want to have just conversations like this and process it together. I also feel like some of that came from my experience in academia, that impulse, that drive, that desire to have just a honest human conversation together. I have been disabled almost my entire life. All of my memory is in this body, but I did not know about disability studies until I was in my late 20s. I'd never even heard a lot of the ideas. The first time I Googled ableism was 2015. And I remember feeling quite shocked that this information, this way of thinking was in the world. And thinking like, how did I not know this? Someone who is deeply affected by this, how did I not have access to these ideas? So I do think that one of the biggest goals that I had when I sat down to write this book that was deeply informed by disability studies and all that I was learning in graduate school was that I wanted it to be a conversation that my 14-year-old niece could be connected to and my 70-year-old mom. You know, I wanted this to be something that you didn't have to have particular training or specialty in. I didn't want there to be words that people would feel alienated by or pushed out by. I wanted it to feel like we're two humans together trying to make sense of what it means to live in this body and how that relates to the environment around us and what that relationship is. So that, I think, was part of my drive. And I guess I got the goosebumps because, you know, you write something with a hope that it will be felt in a certain way. And I love that you felt that.
I did. I also felt the way you do if somebody says, let me share some secrets with you that I haven't told other people.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the book is about how something might happen where you don't go to a party because you don't want to be a burden, or you have some god-awful experience with the dating site, or you're teaching a class and having some resistance from the teenagers in the room, or different things that happen that you then process in a solitary way. You know, don't share those things. But in the book, we're there with you. We kind of get the, it's almost like confessional in a way, but in a way that's empowering because it takes us into your real thoughts and makes us kind of contemplate any time we've ever been sort of obtuse. And you also start with your family in the early chapter where you're the youngest of five. You've had cancer as a baby and paralyzed from age three on. But you grow up in a very unusual way in a family that you say gives you a kind of, what is it, wild freedom or wild emancipation in a sense, because they don't treat you like you have a disability. You describe feeling as close as bubbles in a glass of soda and as far away as Pluto from Earth. Tell us about your role in your family.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, what a question. Thank you for asking that. Yeah, it's interesting because I'm the youngest, and so I don't know what my family was like before my arrival and my cancer, which was a huge disruption. Right? It was catastrophic. It was scary. I was supposed to die, and the cancer treatments last several years. So I know that that became a defining part of my family. But their response, you know, once the dust settled, my body was fundamentally changed. I like slowly became paralyzed over the course of a few months toward the end of my cancer treatments. But their response to that was almost as if nothing had changed at all. You know, I mentioned in the book, like, they didn't start making any adaptations to the house. You know, my bed, I slept in the top bunk on the top floor, the third floor of the house.
I saw that. Yes, and I had a mixed reaction to it. I gotta say, because it's like, why? Why would you have been put on the top bunk, you know, and have to pull yourself up? Why?
It was the coveted spot in the house. So, we had this big family, and we had two bunk beds in one room, and I had earned my way to that spot. It used to be my brother's, and I wanted it. And I suppose my parents felt like as long as I could get up there that they would allow for that. And it's interesting to hear you say mixed, because I feel mixed about it too. And it's taken me a long time to sort of reflect on that choice, the choices that my parents made in that way, and sort of suss out the gifts of that and the loss of that. And I think both of those are pretty profound. I think the gift of it was I developed this scrappiness and it's sort of a creativity in how I moved through the world and figuring it out for myself. Like, I want to get up there. How am I going to use my body to do that thing? And I think there's something empowering about that. And I treasure that scrappiness that I still have. And also, there was a lot that I was experiencing, especially as I got older and older, in this body that was very different than my five older siblings, that I didn't really understand. I didn't have language for it. I didn't even know what to make of it, hardly, you know. It's a strange thing to experience something that is so profound and loud in your everyday life, but to have no space or acknowledgement that it's happening. And so it took me a really long time to even figure out what my story was, what my experience was, and how to articulate that. And I think because it took me a long time, I think that in a lot of ways my siblings didn't know or understand how different my experience was from theirs. And you know, now there's this book, and I think that it's kind of strange for them, you know, that they're like, wow. In the beginning of the book, I talk about my brother David, who's really struggling to understand, like, what is this?
Why do you feel shame?
Yes, why would you feel shame? And so baffled by that, which to me is just this really stark reminder of that gap between our experiences. I think it was a both and for me, and sort of a long journey for me. And I think... what I have come to understand is that I think my parents gave me the very best of what they had to offer. And there was a lot that they didn't know. And I filled in those gaps later, you know, in other places as I got older. But you're right. It's a both and. It's mixed.
And you write about your father's incredible work ethic, getting up so early, 4 a.m, and working every day, no sick days, all that kind of, you know, work ethic, and how that in a way made you feel bad if you had to take a day off from school or were feeling under the weather. But I suppose you grew up in an environment that definitely did not allow you to wallow in self-pity or to, you know, put yourself in a different category from everyone else. I think for me, the heartbreaking part of that early chapter is when you go from feeling royally beautiful and fantasizing about the usual things that little girls fantasize about, and then having the outside world take that away. And I wonder if you can talk about that. You talk about the places where the images don't allow for there to be representation, whether it's in movies or TV shows or books or magazines, and sort of your growing awareness of this image that you don't match.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking to me too to think about that. And I don't think I'm the only child who's experienced that. So I think that I carry that ache with me even as a mom to a son who doesn't have any disabilities that I know of at this point, but just that self-knowing that a lot of times we have when we're very young. Or I don't even know if I would call it self-knowing. It's like this intuitive way of being in the world. Like, I feel like a princess, so therefore I can be a princess, or I see myself that way. And then this sort of slow piecing together, looking around at the world around you and seeing where you fit or don't fit into that world, or where you seem to be represented or not represented in that world. And so for me, it was sort of this slow and steady process of piecing together. I don't look like the princesses, you know. I don't match that storyline. I don't even fit into my school playground, you know. I think that if there's a before and an after, which is hazy because it's a slow and steady process, but I think before it felt like I understood myself as a valuable member of the group. I was one of the pack, equal in that way. And I think over time it felt like I fundamentally don't belong here. I am living in a world, and I would not have articulated this at the time, but the feeling or the things that I'm noticing is that the world was not built to include me. And my presence always seems so disruptive. I show up someplace and it's like, well, how are we going to include her on this field trip? Or, you know, how are we going to get her into this building? And there was that disruption. It seemed like my perception was that society was like this well-oiled machine that worked perfectly well for everyone else. And I was like the only one that just didn't fit into that world. And I felt that for a long time. And it's hard to feel good about yourself, or how would you not develop a certain amount of shame around that? Although I say that, and I know that there are lots of people who also live in worlds that are not, that are inaccessible and don't have that takeaway. I think about someone like Judy Heumann, who grew up in the 1950s in a world that was much less accessible than the one that I lived in, and moved through that world and held on to her sense of belonging and was able to see this world was not built for me and it should be, you know. Mm-hmm. And I didn't interpret it that way. I interpreted it more as like, I'm the problem here. And there is something heartbreaking about any child or young person who starts to absorb the world in that way and take all of the problems of it into your own body.
One of the things you do throughout the book is to compare what you went through and are going through as someone in a wheelchair to many other kinds of experiences of difference and exclusion. And, you know, with the UW Odyssey Project that I direct, I have students who are mostly from communities of color and from low-income backgrounds. And one of them wrote a poem about how when she was 8, she realized that her dark skin made her not fit in. And she talks, she has this line, "I felt my little girl light dim." But then later she embraces her, you know, because she had started to doubt her hair texture, her skin color, you know, didn't match the ones that were the Cinderella and all that. And, you know, so there's the racial differences. You talk about other ways that you see your experiences matching other types of difference that we might not think of. Can you talk about some of those parallels?
Yeah. I think that was sort of this like slow process of learning that there were a lot of people who felt on the outside, people on the edges, people who the world didn't make space for or acknowledge in the same way. I think for me, some of that, I started having more and more conversations with folks. I remember even talking with a woman who would call herself fat. She identified that way. And I had written something about dressing rooms, I think. I can't mm-hmm. remember. But it was almost like she felt apologetic for making the correlation between our experiences, which by the end of the conversation was like, no, this is similar. Uh-huh. This makes sense that that the world was built to accommodate a certain kind of body, and you're made to feel ashamed that you don't fit into the way that built world in that way. And even thinking about, I remember her even describing like the way that a store is set up, that if there are items in that store that even match her body, they're tucked away in the back of the store, mm. right? Like hidden. We're not putting that on
right.
display.
The mannequins always have the tiny
right.
little outfits
yes.
on.
Right, yes. Like all of the ways that we receive these signals that this is not for us. We don't fit in here. And that's just one tiny example of the ways that I feel like I started to have more and more conversations with people who expressed feelings that were that I had felt very alone in. That feeling of being the only one that looks like you when you show up in a room, and all of the feelings that come after that moment, and being self-conscious of feeling like you need to match, feeling like somehow you are failing because you don't match. And that poem that you describe is exactly it, right?
Yeah.
Like, what, my hair should be different. There's something embedded in my body that makes me separate from other people, and wholly different. I think that there are a lot of people who experience that for a lot of different reasons. And I didn't know that when I was younger, mm-hmm. you know, I didn't see that, or understand that. I think actually a lot of us are on the edges instead of in that center.
Yeah, and you referred to sort of being on the edges or margins. Even in the epigraph to the whole book, you write that it's dedicated to everyone with a body that has been sent to the margins. Our stories matter. And I like the emphasis on the storytelling, you know, as we all have these stories, and in those stories are truths, but also the idea that we're all occupying bodies. And you make it clear that even if you are able-bodied for most of your life, you're going to age. You know, you're going to have injuries. You may have disease. That all of us, in a way, are going to need to confront a world where there is disability, where we need access, and why not do it together instead of waiting until, like, oh, that's how it feels.
Yeah, it's kind of puzzling to me, to be honest, that we have all co-signed into this arrangement that is so punishing to all of us, that we've agreed upon these expectations for the more and the speed and the way that we've built the world and designed the world, when all of us are going, our bodies fundamentally will continue to change and age. And I think about even something as ordinary as pregnancy, mm-hmm. right? That's a massive change in your body that that requires different adaptations. You have different sets of needs through that process, but we don't make a lot of space for that. At least in this country, we don't make a lot of space for that. And I think about things like housing. Like, it's so strange to me that all of us will, if we live long enough, if we're lucky enough, right, we will live in bodies that are aging that would benefit from accessible homes. But we don't build accessible homes. I mean, like, rarely are we building homes and living spaces that would accommodate someone to age in place. I don't understand that. I think a lot of it is momentum and change, and changing institutions and changing the way we've always done things is hard. I just hope that the buy-in would be clear enough that we would pivot towards building structures and systems and policies that honor our bodies and the ways that they are forever changing. They're all vulnerable to illness and injury, and inevitably, like, if there's one thing that is true about every human, it is that we will get older every day, and our bodies will respond to gravity and decay. And how are we not thinking about that as we build anything?
We're going to talk more about the book Sitting Pretty, The View from My Ordinary Resilient Disabled Body with the author Rebecca Tausig when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. Ableism separates, isolates, assumes. It's starved for imagination, creativity, and curiosity. It's fueled by fear. It oppresses all of us. That's from the book Sitting Pretty, The View from My Ordinary Resilient Disabled Body by my guest, Dr. Rebecca Tausig. So ableism, that's one of those isms, but it's not as commonly used, I think, as racism, sexism, ageism, even classism. There's a lot of other isms. Can you give us a good definition? I think you start with the dictionary, but then kind of give it your own spin.
Yeah.
Tell us what ableism is and why we should be thinking about that.
Yeah, the standard definition is discrimination against disabled people, which I find terribly vague. Like, what is that discrimination, and who are these people that fit under the umbrella of disability or disabled? The definition I have in the book is much lengthier than the standard Oxford English Dictionary definition. Let's see if I can recount
it.
Sure. Here we go. And I've even kind of added to it over time. But The definition that I have written in the book is that in its most boiled down, squished together, simplified form, ableism is the process of favoring, fetishizing, and building the world around a mostly imagined, idealized body while discriminating against those bodies perceived to move, see, hear, process, operate, look, or need differently from that vision. And often, the greater the deviation, the greater the discrimination. So, in essence, the way that I understand ableism is that it is it's shaping a world around this imagined sort of quote-unquote average person. And by average, I mean the person that has perfect vision, can walk up and down a flight of stairs no problem, doesn't get sick, or if they do, they recover very quickly, sort of this imagined person. But when you drill down on that person, on that idea of that human, very few of us actually match that person in reality. And none of us will over the course of an entire lifetime. That person is like a really good worker and never needs to take a sick day and doesn't get too tired and only needs to use the bathroom, you know, like, I don't know, in some convenient amount of time throughout the day. There are so many ways that that world is shaped for that person. And it is interesting to me how few of us match that person. And so that's where we get in the idea of ableism punishing everyone, is that there is this ideal that we're all striving to match, scrambling to keep up with. And some of us can sort of maintain that for a while. Some of us can't even begin to participate in that. So there's a range of the impact of that. But ultimately, and in the end, everyone is punished. That's where we end up kind of believing that our stories are over once we reach a certain age, that that's the end of the road. And now we'll just like slowly go off, fade off from view. Right. Like that is a setup that hurts all of us in the long run. So the other thing I will add is that one definition that I read of ableism that is quite a bit shorter that resonated with me after writing this book is from a man named Norman Kunk, disability activist. And his definition of ableism is that ableism is the belief that people should be non-disabled, which I think gets to the heart of some of it. That there is a way to be a human that is right, and then there is a way that is wrong, that something went wrong, and this is no longer how a human body should be. And we are going to build the world for the right kind of human body, and then maybe, after the fact, make some kind of roundabout point of access for all of the bodies that are not as they should be. And the shift there would be to recognize that humans come in every possible form, and that's human. That is actually what being human is, and honoring that, and building a world that reflects that reality.
You also talk in the book about how some groups, for example, the deaf community, sometimes resist this idea that hearing is better. That there are certain qualities that they have within that community that they cherish, or someone who has some other, you know, different way of looking at the world that may like some of those attributes. So ableism also includes, if I follow your book right, those who don't allow for other ways to sort of have their own merit.
Yeah.
That are constantly trying to fix or cure or make everyone sort of standardized.
Yes. Thank you for bringing that up. I mean, that kind of goes back to that chapter where the teaching chapter where I think the title is More Than a Defect. In that chapter, I describe teaching disability studies in a high school English class.
Which is brave. That's a
Oh my gosh, thank you. Whew, that was one of the hardest chapters to write. I felt like every time I sat down to write that chapter, I was like diving into an ice cold pool of water, just like. And the vulnerability of sharing all of my own fumbles in teaching, you know, I there are so many things I would have done differently and looking at how that went. But one of the things that came up a lot in that class is that some students really struggled to see disability as something other than a defect. I remember specifically a conversation about deafness where there were students that were like, but it literally means you can't hear. That is literally just the loss of something. How is that anything other than just a simple defect? And trying to expand the way of thinking and yes, deaf culture and deaf community is a vibrant way of moving through the world, and people value that way of being tremendously. So yes, I think that ableism has a hard time imagining that, right? It's kind of stuck in this very rigid, small way of thinking about what it means to live in a body and move through the world of the senses. So deafness, and I think also I hear that from a lot of folks. Often people who have lived in a disabled body most of their life, but people who acquire that later in life as well. I hear people describe a lot of complexity in the experience of disability, and not all of it. The experience of it for those folks is not a simple loss of a sense or a function, but a way of being in the world that comes with a lot of beauty and a different way of moving through the world that they value. So yeah, I think ableism would have no space for that, right? It would not acknowledge or recognize that as a valuable asset to a human life or to a community at large.
When you talk about teaching high school, you talk about it being, you know, this, first of all, the joy of having an adult job, you know, this sort of full-time job, but then some of the practical things, like the fact that you're going to be down at that lower level if you're sitting in a wheelchair, how are you going to connect to the students? Do you go into the cafeteria and get lunch? How are you going to balance the coffee cup? And, you know, a lot of practical things. But the part that really resonated with me as a English teacher,
yeah,
is just that desire to engage with students and the assumption sometimes that they're going to be so inspired and moved, and then you look out and maybe the faces are not registering that. You talk about students who really push back when you try to bring them the good news about the social model versus the medical model of disability. Can you share a little bit of that, just the experience of thinking that everyone's going to be so blown away by what you were inspired by, and then kind of getting these blank faces?
Yeah, it was startling. It was a huge shift in my life arc. You know, if we would say that, you know, as we've talked about a little bit here, I felt valuable as a young child. I developed a lot of shame and came to feel like I didn't belong in the world. And then there was this shift where I found disability studies and I started to understand my place in the world differently and understand my experience differently and recognized something as big and pervasive as ableism for the first time. And it was revelatory, right? It changed my whole life. So how could it not, right? How could it not mean as much to every student that would encounter it? And so I went into this first job so hopeful and excited and eager for everyone else to feel this revelation and inspiration. And it was not like that. It was jarring. And I think at first part of my deep depths of despair had to do with feeling like I'd gotten it wrong. Like I was foolish to buy into this way of looking at the world. And I wish that that was not the case. I wish that I don't like admitting that, but that was the feeling. And I remember after some really rough conversations in that class, I was like at a flea market moving through this space and feeling like everyone around me is looking at me as if I am the defect that my students are describing with disability, right? Like I had uncovered this truth, this like ugly truth that really all of the worst fears that I had about how people view me in a room or in a community were true. And that was devastating professionally and personally. It was very hard. And I think, you know, slowly over time, I think I came to understand a few things that shaped that experience that were more complicated than just that initial blow to my spirit. And part of it was things like, you know, that almost had nothing to do with the content. It was like I was a new teacher at the school. Those kids had been really excited to get a different teacher, and then they had me, and it wasn't what they expected. And, you know, I think also recognizing their age and their life experience and knowing that for a lot of them, these were actually just seeds that maybe would come back to them in 5 or 10 years. And just kind of reflecting on that at a distance was helpful. But it was a very painful experience, and writing about it was a painful experience. But I felt like it was valuable to write about, in part because it felt like it a great container to explore some of these questions that are really hard for people, that like aren't easy to grapple with, that some of these ideas that we have about bodies are deeply ingrained in us from before we even knew we were gathering ideas about the world, right?
Well, and they're reinforced by representations on screen, for example. I mean, you talk about how either it's the monstrous, you know, the hunchback, or it's the angelic Helen Keller or Forrest Gump or, you know, inspirational, that there are these types, but not the nuances.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it makes me think about the film Me Before You. I had my students watch that film that semester. And for those who don't know, it's an adaptation of a book that tells a story of a man who is injured at the beginning of the story in like the prime of his life. He's like a successful, handsome, rich man, rich white man. And he is injured. He gets hit by a car at the beginning of the story and becomes a quadriplegic and ends up falling in love with a woman who's been hired to be his caregiver. And by the end of the film, he decides to end his own life to spare her the burden of his care. It's a horrifying film. I mean, like, to me, I watch that and my whole body is aching and screaming. And the idea that other people will see this story and absorb that and think that's like,
That was
heroic,
a good self-sacrificing move.
Yeah, and so in this class, I remember we watched it, and I was just like so ready for them to be like, that was ridiculous, and the main response was like, oh, that is the sweetest movie, and the disconnect there was so troubling to me. Mm-hmm. I had hoped that would be obvious, and it wasn't, which I think just speaks to the power of storytelling. And the stories that we receive shaping our perceptions of human life. And so, yeah, that was one of many. I also had the students find their own story that represented disability in one way or another and kind of write a reflection on it. And, you know, there were a lot of reflections on, like, Forrest Gump and how amazing this inspirational guy was. And just seeing the way that these stories fed into and reinforced these tropes and really one-dimensional ways of thinking about disability. And at that time, especially, it felt very hard to find any kind of storytelling or representation that did bring us into that nuanced understanding of disability, like all the mixed both-ands that we've already been talking about, the richness of that life, the layers and dimensions of that life. It's very hard. And even today, I think it's a little bit better, but even today, it's really hard to find that kind of storytelling that represents the full human experience.
Right. And you also talk about how so much of the portrayal, the news stories, will focus on the hero who is helping the victim, you know, the one that the football team captain that takes the disabled girl to prom, or but the focus is on the goodness of that hero for doing that thing, not, you know, that also skews things. Yeah, I wanted to ask you too about your the chapter on kindness is a real, and you warn readers, this is going to be uncomfortable, it may kind of challenge some things, but the idea that maybe someone who approaches you when they see you in a wheelchair and tries to help you or open a door, or, you know, acts uncomfortable when you're putting your chair together after driving in hand-controlled vehicle and so on, that kind of challenges our assumption that we should help, that we should be there. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that chapter on kindness. Why did you feel so, you know, strongly that you needed to write that?
Yeah. Well, I will say, yes, it makes a lot of people uncomfortable, especially my parents. My parents have a very hard time with that chapter. And I, you know, I've done so many Q&As and book club conversations, and I don't think there's almost a single one that goes by without somebody being like, but okay, help me understand. Because this is a very, very hard, it's a pushback against something that I think most of us really value highly, which is kindness. We want to be kind people. And now I'm throwing out this narrative that maybe the things we thought were kind are not so kind, and that's hard. I think that my interactions with folks around kindness has been one of the defining experiences that has made me feel like every social interaction is a pre-written script, that we already have the roles that we play before we even arrive on scene, that we already are this certain, we're pigeonholed into the characters, and we're going to perform this act over and over again. And I feel that way because I noticed that moving through the world, it is very common for people to react to me in a certain way, which is falling over themselves to try to help. And I feel like I am like a symbol of helplessness, that I move through the world as a symbol that people read very quickly and immediately as like, she needs my assistance, she needs my intervention. Even when, you know, if you took like two more seconds to notice or pay attention or look, I'm fine, right? I actually have got my luggage. I'm moving my chair and my car very quickly. Do you see how competent I am? And so it felt to me like something that was invisible to a lot of people that I wanted to name. And I think also, if we really do value being kind, which I think most people do, I'm going to go ahead and believe that most of us want to be kind and extend kindness, then to me, I think that those people would want to know what feels like actual kindness, you know?
So we need to ask. I think that's what I took away, is that not to assume. But it's hard, because I'll give you an example. This morning when you came to the radio station and I saw that you were coming, and I know there's buttons that you can push that will automatically open the door. After reading your book, I'm not sure if I should open that door.
Yeah.
And I've seen that happen with my father, who's 95 and uses a walker, but is very sharp and together and independent too. Sometimes it is hard to know how to give help without taking away someone's independence, taking away their options. And you know, instead it seems there are times in the book where you're happy when somebody just sees you triumphantly doing something and lets you do that. So I think the take home for me was ask, listen, be open to different ways of helping.
Yes. And I love that you gave that specific example, because as soon as you take the ideas of the book and apply it to real life, there's a million tiny and enormous moments every day when it's like, but what do
you
do here?
Now?
Yeah,
and we're afraid. I think with a lot of the times when we're trying to do the right thing, there is this fear, oh, I'm going to get it wrong. I'm going to be offensive when I don't mean to. So I think you do ask all of us just to listen more. Yeah. We're going to talk about disability and romance and motherhood when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. There weren't any paralyzed girls or women included in the stories told on screen, through ads, or in magazine pages. I was not among those who would be needed, admired, wanted, loved, dated, or married. I began to see myself as weak and helpless, too. Those are the words of Dr. Rebecca Taussig in her memoir, Sitting Pretty, The View from My Ordinary Resilient Disabled Body. I loved the way you talked about, throughout the book, about people's assumption that if you're in a wheelchair, you're not going to get married. You couldn't possibly become a mother. You know, you're not the romantic girl that we expect. You even talk about when you are dating, people assuming you're siblings, or how could this be? tell us about, well, and also the fact that in one instance, the lack of health insurance motivated you into marriage. Tell us about this whole romantic world and how you found your place in it.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that comes back to, it reminds me of our conversation about storytelling and representation. Like, who do we imagine in the center of romance? And who do we imagine, what do we even imagine partnership to look like? And I know in particular, when disability is included in partnership, there's a lot of skepticism. There is a lot of framing the non-disabled partner as a hero. I think that, you know, I've heard lots of people do like asking like, what would you do in this scenario thing? Like listening to podcasts and stuff where people be like, but what would you do if your partner became paralyzed? Like as if that meant a fundamentally different relationship. You know, I think that that is embedded in the way that we think about humans as another mm-hmm. narrative that we have. And disability, there's not a space for disability in that or hasn't been represented that way. And so when you try to push yourself into that storyline, it comes with a lot of discomfort and awkwardness and even confusion from people, especially on like the online dating world. So I've been married twice. My first marriage, a lot of that unfolded in part because you mentioned like the need for health insurance, and that's like a very powerful force in this country that we're making big decisions out of the necessity for health insurance. But also part of it was this narrative that no one is going to choose me as a partner. And the fact that my high school boyfriend wanted to be with me at all mm-hmm. must mean that this is my one chance at love in my whole life. And so what will I compromise to have that love? It turned out that it like felt better to be alone than to be partnered with the wrong person.
But it took you, about 6 months?
It was pretty fast. It was shockingly to everyone around us quite fast. But it's, I think, narrative. I think it's what we imagine relationships to look like and partnership to look like and who a romantic interest is. And disability is rarely included in that.
Well, we don't talk about a lot of it either. Like, can you have sex? How would it be different? Can you give birth? What would that be like? There are a lot of questions that maybe people think but don't ask.
Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I think a lot of that comes it reminds me of what we've said about like ableism punishing everyone, because I think openness about like about sex in a relationship, of like what sex will be mean to us or what you will prefer in this relationship, is assumed for onto all kinds of people, right? And we just see evidence of that in disability, that we this doesn't fit into the tiny thing that we've imagined. But how many ways do we not fit mm-hmm. into that tiny way that we've conceived of sex or partnership in general? I think about if the goal is to have a long partnership with someone, do you not expect disability will at some point become a part mm-hmm. of that partnership? So what do we imagine a relationship to be? What do we imagine a sexual relationship to be? And should we be imagining more across the board? Should we be more open or curious?
And you use that word imagination a lot, I think, in the book, that we really need to imagine different ways, broader ways, you know, more alternatives than what we're stuck with, that it's not all going to be like watching soap operas and Baywatch, and you know, that there yes. are different ways of living in the world. Can you tell us about your marriage and motherhood? At the end of Sitting Pretty, you add a postscript at that point saying that you're pregnant and you're married, but then we don't get the sort of more recent things in the
yes.
years that have followed.
Thank you for the question, yeah. because I do feel a little guilty that I just land on this giant cliffhanger. And yes, so the first thing I would like to say is that my partner, Micah, is doing well. He's been cancer-free for several years, and we are unspeakably grateful for that. Mm-hmm. His body has been fundamentally altered through cancer, and not in the same way that mine was yeah. altered from cancer, but fundamentally changed. And that has been a big adjustment for him and has been something for me to witness, you know. That's been an important part of the second half of our marriage. And then, yes, my son was born. My son was born in May of 2020, and he has completely turned our lives upside down in all of the hardest and best ways. He is quite an amazing human. I recognize my biases, but I do believe that is true. Motherhood in particular was quite a difficult adjustment for me. And it was kind of strange because this book came out just a few months after my son was born. And in those early months, I was grappling with some of the deepest internalized ableism that I have ever felt in my life. In some ways, I think I was also experiencing postpartum. I didn't recognize it. Or I'm sorry, postpartum depression. Mm-hmm. I didn't recognize it as that at the time. It felt much more like I had a narrative over what my feelings were. And it was that my body was insufficient for the task of motherhood. And that has quickly, I don't want to say quickly, that has evolved. He's four now. And I have had a much longer stretch of time to process what it means to me to be a disabled mother. And I think that will continue to evolve as he hits different ages. And right now he just started at a new school. And so every day that I show up to pick him up, there are a bunch of 4 and 5 year olds that are saying, why do you use a wheelchair? Why do you use a wheelchair? And it's a different experience for me. I'm very used to children's questions. I'm not used to navigating that with my son right next to me and how I want him to experience that moment. And so,
but what an opportunity for the children that are in his class to have that be sort of just part of their regular experience.
That's my hope, right? Yeah. And the regular part is key. I had a conversation with his teacher early in the year where she was like, well, could you come in and maybe talk to the kids and do some educating? And I felt like, I don't know that I want to do that, in part because it feels like it creates this spotlight on our family. Like, our family is the only family that has anything different about it. And for my son to experience it that way felt strange. So what I have tried to do and what we're continuing to work on is just me being in the classroom more and having my presence be ordinary to them, right? This is just another way of being in the world. And I am excited about the idea of those kids getting to have that picture in their early formative memories.
And if you had a chance in there, you've got a minute, and you're sitting next to someone on the airplane, and they say, sort of, what's the point of this book, or what's your life work heading toward? You can just sort of give them, in a nutshell, what you most hope people take away. What would that be?
This is a good question for me because I'm never brief, so thank you for the prompt. If I could be succinct, I think it's maybe twofold. I think one of the things that I hope is that my work gives us a picture of a nuanced experience of disability in the world, full of all the both ands, all of the pain points and joys and richness of that experience. I want representation like that in the world for all of our benefits, right? I think a second tier or fold of that has to do with wanting us as a culture to really grapple with the reality of what it means to live in a human body. It's so strange to me that we all move through the world tethered to this one body for our whole lives. And it feels like how little we think about that until we're forced to think about that. And I would love for us to be able to ruminate on that together and process that together. Mortality and fragility and vulnerability of living in a body together so that our world can be shaped to reflect that. That's my attempt at brevity.
Great. My guest has been Rebecca Tausig. Her memoir, Sitting Pretty, was chosen as the Go Big Read for the University of Wisconsin campus, with students reading it, the community reading it. And I congratulate you on this book and on your work, and hope to see the next book out when you have a chance to kind of add to it. So thank you for being my guest.
Oh, thank you so much for having me and for your thoughtful questions. This was so fun for me.
I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.